The following is a conversation with Michael Abdennour that I had with him while filming the second episode from season 2 of The Huntsman. Michael is an amazing guy. He's a smart guy. He's switched on. He's passionate. He's driven. He owns the business Eagle Eye Hunting Gear as well as Smart Rest. He is an inventor of hunting products. He's passionate about the hunting industry, and we had a great conversation about all those things and more. Encourage you to go check it out and watch it now. Also, if you're not a member of the Australian Hunters Club and you want to support me and support yourself, that is the best way to do it, by checking out australianhunters.com.au. We're a fantastic community. We're a growing community where you can gain access to professionally guided hunt giveaways every single month. You can win one. You can win hunting products every month. We have a huge hunters directory that you can use to connect with local hunters. You can go on people's hunts. You can host your own hunts and events. We've got our camp coming up, whole bunch of cool stuff. Encourage you to check it out if you haven't already checked it out, australianhunters.com.au. But otherwise, without further ado, onto the conversation with Michael.
I hunt animals in the pursuit of life. Life lived and life taken. I believe it's through this dance with nature and the wild places that we truly live, connect, and grow. I'm Chris Waters, the Huntsman, and these are my stories.
I'm here with Michael Abdennour, and we are sitting in a shearing shed in New South Wales at tail end of summer, but it's supposed to be pretty hot today. It's supposed to be like 33 degrees. And at the moment, it's been pretty nice. And we've been hunting last night, hunting this morning, filming the second episode in The Huntsman season 2. And Michael, I've known Michael for a couple of years now. And I've actually wanted to talk to you for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
Because you've got really interesting perspectives on things that differ from my own. And not in terms of we don't disagree. We just represent different angles that I think are worth talking about.
Yeah.
But also, Michael runs a really cool business, Eagle Eye Hunting Gear. And we can talk about that, as well as our Smart Rest. It develops cool hunting technologies, I think, worth talking about too. So
it's a business to you, but it's an obsession to me.
We were talking,
it's an insane obsession to me.
We were talking about this last night, that we share a similar burden, in that once you have an idea, like, it just takes hold of you. And for you, that's like inventing and engineering cool new hunting tools and tech that help you with, you know, yeah, achieving your hunting goals. Yeah. And for me, that's more like creative things or platforms and things like that. But you mentioned, maybe this is a good question to start off with, because we touched on this last night and I think it's worth talking about. What is the process that you go through to develop a new piece of hunting equipment? Like, how does it start? What's the genesis of the idea?
Well, originally it was just because purely out of need. So mother of all inventions is need.
Yeah.
A necessity. So we were kind of like shooting a lot. We, you know, obviously we grew up shooting.
Yeah.
And we had bought our first kind of rifle.
Yeah.
Me and my brother. And
what was it? What caliber?
17 HMR.
Yeah, nice.
So, you know, we intended to shoot some rabbits with it.
Yeah.
But out in the field, you know, out on the back of the ute, you're trying to shoot and at 100 meters, 150 meters.
Yeah.
It starts to get a bit tough.
Yeah.
And realized that, hey, we need something to rest off.
Yeah.
And what was already out there wasn't really fitting our needs. It was kind of thereabouts, but not.
How long ago was this in terms of years?
We're talking 12 years.
I know
years,
you're pretty young.
12 years now. Yeah.
Really? Only 12 years ago. Okay.
Yeah, 12 years ago. Roughly, I think.
Yeah. I think people forget how far
time flies.
And how far the Australian market has come in terms of hunting gear. Like 12 years ago, there would have been like nothing.
At the time, there was not much to offer.
Yeah.
Accessories only just come along.
Yeah, recently.
Quite recently, not that long. At the time, we were thinking about, you know, different objects that were already out there.
Yeah.
And we'd go to the local gun shop and say, we're shooting off the back of the ute and we're trying to shoot accurately.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't what we wanted. So yeah. My original trade was spray painting. So
okay.
I was in the car, vehicle auto trade.
Yeah, yeah.
And it opened a box and I noticed that there was this big block of foam.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's interesting. It just hit me.
Yeah.
So I started cutting off stuff and, you know, trying it. And I thought, wow, that really works well as a
dresser.
Took it back to my brother. And went, what do you reckon of this?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, that's awesome. But, you know, maybe we should put some magnets, or maybe we should, you know, hold it down. Something to hold it down on the roof
yeah, yeah.
while we're driving around. Because it was very popular very common back then. You jump on the back of the ute.
Yeah.
And you drive around with a spotlight.
Yeah, you basically got like a bar across the top of the ute. Yeah. You're putting your rifle on. And if you were feeling particularly kind to your gear, you'd put like a pool noodle over it to help to not smash.
Slow. So you might hold your spotlight and somebody else is shooting. Yeah. You needed a bit more height. So anyway, the story went that we needed that item. I built it, I designed it, and you know, created this whole thing.
Yeah.
Went out and tried it. It's like, wow, this thing is incredible.
Yeah.
I'm loving this thing. So I took it to my local gun shop, Safari Firearms, and I said to Gary,
which is a big firearm store.
And Gary's the type of guy that he backs people. Like, you know, he'll say, yeah, I think that's a good idea, or, you know, like,
no, it's trash.
Well, he doesn't just say, oh, yeah, good luck to you and go off and do your own thing. He's we're doing a show with SSAA. Why don't you come and give it a shot?
Yeah.
And I've touched that, have I?
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah.
Oh, you've broken it now.
Yeah.
That's fine.
It's the Leaning Tower. so he goes, why don't you come and give it a shot and see if you can sell some?
Mm.
So we went there and like, we had people, dealers actually were walking around and they said, we like that.
And this is the genesis of the Max Box.
Yeah, this is the very first thing that I built for the hunting industry. I built many things before. It's just that I never really took it anywhere.
And so this first run that you did, like, are you just buying blocks of foam and then you're just carving?
No, I went and sourced foam suppliers.
Yeah.
Australian suppliers were hopeless.
Because that would have been hard. That wouldn't have been really easy.
That was the biggest hurdle at the time.
Yeah, and expensive too.
It was expensive.
And minimum orders and all sorts of shenanigans that you would have to go through.
Yeah, when you're first starting out, nobody really wants to see what you've got to do.
Yeah.
What got to say or anything like that.
Because there's some kid.
Oh, that's impossible. Yeah, like this guy. Who's this guy?
You know? He just wants to shoot buddies. Yeah,
that's right. And in an industry, really, that's quite small, you know. But I didn't know any of that. I just said, oh, this is a good idea. I want to see it to the end.
Yeah,
it's the first time I want to see something that I've built to the end and actually get it on the market. I can build stuff, but I kind of had this idea and I wanted to get it out. And like I said, I didn't want anything to get in my way. But I had no idea what the hell I was doing. And I was really lucky, very, very fortunate that my wife is a bookkeeper and she's been working around freight and businesses for so long, way before I was doing anything like this. So I needed her expertise, and without her this wouldn't even, it'd just be like a great idea and some backyard blokes just, you know, building stuff and selling them, which is fine. But if you want to do a, you know, set up a proper business and all, she's the backbone of the business, you know. She's always been there from day one, but nobody sees her. She just does her thing, you know.
Mm.
She prefers it that way,
mm.
but yeah, it is what it is. It's not a kiss ass line or nothing, but it's just, you know, it's the reality of it. You know, people have great ideas all the time, and you can have great ideas and try to take it to market, but if you don't set it up right, it doesn't. It most likely just won't go anywhere. But also, when people come over and they'll say, "Oh, I've got this product that I want to get out on the market." I never turn them down. I'll always look at it and always say, what is it and where can we get it out? And some things take off really well. Some things don't, you know. And as long as you give it a crack, I don't like to just discount people and say, not good enough.
Hmm.
Like I said earlier, it was an obsession.
Yeah.
It's a curse at the same time.
Well, it's 100% a curse.
Yeah, it's a curse.
Just ask our loved ones.
So
I'll tell you.
It went from that. At the show, at the SSAA show, it went really well. And like people saying, oh, get us this, get us that.
Yeah.
I had already sourced all the factories, so if I wanted to pull the trigger, I could.
Yeah.
And good response, so I started with that. And then after that, it was really, it's kind of like the feedback from customers.
Mm.
We'd talk to people, do you like that Maxbox?
Mm.
Yeah, we like it. Could you build one for the door? Or do you have one for the door? And I don't like saying no, so I'm like, yeah.
We've got one. It's just currently in the works.
My mind's ticking 1,000 miles an hour. Yeah, I'll have one in a week, you know.
Yeah.
Start cutting up my ones and I'll start building another one.
Yeah.
And I had one for the door. So the Door Pro came out.
Yeah. Out,
you know? But it takes a lot of investment. It's investment in time and, you know, the real truth, the hard fact of it is you have to back it with money.
Yeah.
Somewhere you've got to get your money and you've got to back it.
And that's a huge risk. The money part of it's not even necessarily like, you say like back it with money, but what you're actually saying is back it with money that we don't know will bring a yield a return. Like
it's a
you
risk.
Just got to trust.
It's a risk. And even if you did sell them, you don't know that your investment's going to, you know, bring back what it costs.
Yeah.
And then to reinvest again.
Yeah.
So in the early days, we were actually looking for investors because I had some money, but my brother didn't really want to put any money in at the time.
Yeah.
And we said, oh, maybe we should go and get investors, get someone to see if they want to buy a container load. You know. So we went to the big guys. I won't mention too many names, but we went to the big guys and they were not really interested. They were kind of like, nah, don't care, don't want to know about it. We had meetings and it's kind of like, nah, it won't work, it's too hard, or nah, it's not a sellable product. And, okay, well, like I said, nothing was going to stop me. I didn't care what you were going to say.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's when we actually formed our own company between me and my brother, and we actually launched the product officially, and we sent it out to dealers. And
so
we honestly
that,
had no idea what we were doing.
So was the company Eagle Eye or Smart Rest?
Eagle Eye.
Okay.
Smart Rest came down the track.
Okay.
Because Eagle Eye was between me and my brother. Because I'm known as Hawk, right? That's my nickname.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. No, my nickname is Hawk. And the name Eagle Eye was like, we thought, this is how naive we were. We thought, we'll make it sound American.
Yeah, it's almost that's not a bad idea. Yeah. When considering the market at the time.
We had no idea. My brother was a panel painter, I was a spray painter.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it was just kind of like, we just wanted to give this a shot.
Yeah.
We said if we made 10 grand out of this thing, we're going to be over the moon.
Oh, wow.
That was our goal.
Nice.
If we make $10,000, wow.
Yeah, wow. Look at that. That's it. Yeah.
So we thought it would be a great success.
Which, when you think about it, like how much were you selling the Maxbox for originally?
About $60, roughly, 55 to 60.
Okay.
Just depending on which part of the country.
That's a lot of Maxboxes to sell to get, like, I'm not sure what your profits were, and I'm not going to ask, but, probably at the start, not that great. Like,
look, it was okay. You know, it was no world beat or anything. It's the shooting industry. It's not like you're bringing out WD-40.
Mm.
You know, that's like nearly every man and his dog needs WD-40 in his garage around the world.
Mm.
You know, it's not limited to the shooting industry in Australia, which if you look at, you've maybe got 1 million shooters that are active. Then out of those 1 million, half of them only shotgun and trap shoot. Half of them might only just target shoot.
Yeah.
So active shooters that are going out in the field and actually culling, shooting, pest control, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe 1/4 million people.
Yeah.
That.
In Australia, which really is very different numbers from America.
Well, very different, yeah. And also our culture is different to America too. So it's not, I mean, we shoot a lot. We shoot a lot of animals here. So from what I can see from my business and things that we do, like the thermal attachments, which came on, obviously down the track. Thermals are mainly bought for pest control.
Yeah.
You know,
and
for all the attachments that we make, we sell thousands and thousands of attachments, you know, so obviously there's a market there.
Yeah.
But again, it's probably 100,000 people that are doing that. And that's the market that's driving the Australian market.
You know? I'm interested what your thoughts are in, because obviously since that time, the business has grown, you've grown your product range, you understand the Australian market better, but you also have a reach into the international space, I'm assuming the American space. Is Australia quite unique in the sense of the way that we manage invasive species and pests and the priority we put on eradicating them? Is that similar to America? Like are the Americans that are buying your products, buying it to shoot coyotes and...
Yeah.
And things and rabbits and things like that, or foxes, or
from the feedback we get, it'd be people that are buying rack and rest for their cars.
Yeah.
They've got a bit of an advantage because they're actually left hand drive. So if you're a right hand shooter sitting on the driver's side, you got the rack and rest on your left hand side and you're leaning over and it's ideal for them.
Yeah.
That's one advantage they've got. But they're mainly buying it for coyotes and prairie dogs.
Yeah.
They don't have the kind of pest. Pigs as well, sorry. Maybe pigs as well.
Yeah.
But in Australia, we've got more pests than we have shooters. Whereas I think over there, they have more shooters than they have pests. So it's different distribution of what is necessary.
Yeah. And
the workload one person would have also comes down to the property sizes.
Yeah.
When I was in, just changing countries, in England, when I went there to do an expo there.
Yeah. They've got a completely different culture.
It's different because their block sizes are smaller.
Yeah.
So this doesn't make sense to jump in a ute and drive around for an hour.
Yeah.
And try to shoot as many pests as you can. Whatever pests you're shooting.
You just walk.
For them, they can sit in a blind. from one corner and they can see the whole block to the other corner.
Mm.
And they're allowed to use suppressors, which we can't. So it's a different dynamic. Mm. It's not that we don't sell there. We do, and we have a very good distributor over there that does our work for us, like as a partner.
Yeah.
We do sell to them. It's just that it's not like Australia. Australia's a way bigger market than America and UK.
In terms of pest.
In terms of what we do here.
Yeah, that's fascinating because... Yeah, everything else that I've heard about the firearm market and hunting apparel and all that is that America has such a bigger market. But it's interesting to know that when you actually look at pests specifically and accessories that help you manage pests, that we have a bigger chunk of the pie than they do. That's fascinating. I think most people, when you explain it, when people start to think, it becomes obvious. You're like, oh, yeah, of course. That makes total sense. But then it's not immediately obvious. But,
I mean, we wouldn't be the best gauge of this anyway because we're only a small company.
Yeah.
Like you might get much, much better kind of, I don't know, data in that from maybe OSA or somebody that's a lot bigger than us that has that sort of reach.
But OSA are like they're like a distributor, right? They're not making their products.
No. So... I mean, I can only give you from my experience, and it doesn't mean it's rock solid and in concrete. It's just what the data we get back.
Yeah.
Maybe we just don't have the right partners yet in the USA.
Mm.
We've been trying, but there's been a little bit of, it takes off slightly and then it kind of dies.
Yeah.
It's maybe a lack of effort on my behalf. Like I focus here. Yeah. It's my country here, so I don't really... I mean, for the UK, I didn't hardly do anything. They chased us and they said, we want to do your product here in the UK. I said, buy it for a dollar, sell it for whatever you want.
Yeah.
That's simple to me.
Yeah.
That's how I do business. It's like, there's nothing difficult about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Buy it for what you want to buy it for and sell it for what you want to sell it for. And
as
long as it's reasonable and people are buying it, it means you're doing a good job.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, maybe my data is not going to be accurate compared to others, but that's what I got.
So it's interesting that what we were talking about, what I alluded to at the start of the conversation is that, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, but I think you have a much stronger experience of the shooter space and understand the mind of a shooter more. Mm. And that's foreign to me. I know that my friend Dodge often talks about people come into like the hunting shooting space in one of two directions. Like you come in as like someone who grew up around firearms and shooting, you enjoy shooting. And then all of a sudden you're like, hey, maybe I want to get into like hunting. And so then you kind of move into rifle hunting because through that avenue. And that was for the longest time, I think the most common pathway or gateway into hunting. But what I'm seeing in the last 15 years, 10 years is a shift in people coming into hunting cold, like no shooting experience, no experience with firearms of any kind, and they have to learn that shooting space. And that's like that's a kind of culture that I came through. I mean, I grew up with the occasional fox shoot or rabbit shoot or spotlight, or the occasional go to my uncle's farm and fire the 22 at like a Coke can on a fence post. But I wasn't doing it every day. I wasn't doing it every week. I wasn't even doing it every month. Mm. And so... firearms, there was an adjustment for me to kind of understand firearms, and even I'm still refining my skills and techniques with firearms. Mm. And like in some ways I feel like I have more hunting experience and my firearm experience is catching up. It's having to play catch up, which is difficult because that's the pointy end of a hunt, right? It's like when you pull the trigger, like that's what the part that you really need to work.
Yeah.
Other stuff you can kind of fumble and bumble around with. Like you might run into deer, you might not. You might run into goats or pigs. But at the end of the day, if you can't shoot straight, there's a serious issue. But I mean, you were raised around firearms or?
Yeah, grew up around firearms.
Yeah.
I held guns since I was six or seven.
Yeah, okay.
I was always around them. Had an air rifle, the best gift. Yeah, best gift I ever received was my dad. My dad bought us an air rifle, me and my brother, on my birthday.
Yeah.
It was the best gift ever.
Yeah.
And we flogged that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, to the, it just
died. Was it a single shot?
Single shot, break barrel.
How good is that?
Yeah.
You would have put so much work into it.
Sights.
That's why you got big cannons, big arms, because you're just cranking it.
I don't know how many. I think we put in at least 100,000 little.
It would have been stuffed by the end of it.
You buy a little packet of 500.
Yeah.
And we'd go up to my uncle's farm, and 3 or 4 days of me and my brother, and we had like my little cousin, who actually shoots with us now, but
yeah.
My little cousin used to chase us, 3-4 years younger than us. He'd follow us around everywhere, and all we'd want to do is just shoot little birds out of the tree.
Yeah.
That's all we could shoot. We couldn't chase anything else. So,
yeah.
But it's just break it open, bang, I take a shot.
Yeah.
Mostly miss.
Yeah, like 90, but it forces you to learn.
Misses.
Yeah.
And then give it to him. He takes a shot. He was younger than me. And so we'd go back and forth, back and forth. And it's just more and more shooting you do, you just hone your skills. And you know what? A lot of it comes down to as well, you've got to actually have that conviction that I want to kill this animal.
Mm.
If you're kind of half-hearted, you'll hesitate. You'll kind of hope you miss.
Mm.
You don't even know you're doing it.
Mm.
But I've seen people do that.
Sabotage themselves.
They sabotage themselves. I've done it to myself because sometimes I've lined up an animal and thinking, you know, I don't really want to kill this thing because it's just not in a mood.
Yeah.
And I'll miss on purpose. Like, not knowing that I'm going to miss, I'll just pull a bad shot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'll go, I'm kind of glad I missed that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just move on. I don't,
you know, don't think about it.
Think about that. But... I think that want and that drive to actually do the final, take the final shot and have a successful kill. If you truly want to do it, you'll find every which way you have to.
Yeah.
Because you got to hone your skill to what you are good at and how you can manipulate machines. And not everybody writes the same.
Yeah.
Not everybody uses drills or cordless drills or anything like that the same.
Yeah.
Everyone's got this slightly different technique.
Yeah,
you really got to just keep on doing it, keep at it until it's almost second nature to you.
Yeah.
So when you got it that way, sometimes your first shot is bad, and you need to follow up.
Yeah, and it's just bad.
It's just nature. It's got to be your second nature to just go reload and take that shot and make up for the mistake you made the first time.
Yeah.
You know, we've all got experiences like that.
Yeah.
All of us do. So yeah, I don't know. The more you do it, the more your brain fills up with data.
I think you're spot on though that, two things, what you just said at the end, I'll bounce off that first in that it's, I think people fail to understand the importance of data, which you can translate to experience.
Yeah.
If you go out and you take a shot, you can just go shoot and then miss and then be like, I'll just do another one and not stop and think, stop and reflect.
Yeah.
And I think it's that the trick is that mindfulness to kind of, and I'm not talking about being overly spiritual or anything. It's just like, think about what you did. Think about your position. Think about the situation and find and kind of lock it in your mind and even have a guess at what you did wrong and then test it and try it again.
Yeah.
And I think this is my experience. Maybe it's just because I'm an airhead and I forget to do this all the time. But from what I've seen is most people nowadays don't think, they just do.
Mm.
And so they do a lot of doing and then they don't grow and they don't learn because they're not thinking and then making educated decisions. And therefore shooting becomes very hard for them. Mm. I think you just have to stop even when you're hunting. And if you bump an animal, go, okay, why did I bump that animal? And start to kind of amass this database of information that you can query after the hunt and during your next hunt.
Yeah.
And I don't think people do that.
Maybe. I haven't hunted with enough people to kind of like say, a lot of people do that. And I'm sure there's plenty of people that get success out of their hunts and stuff. And there are. I mean, we see a lot of those social media posts and all those.
Just talking about them.
Those animals that they've shot. And obviously they're getting great success. And there's a lot of really skilled people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you know, if we can help the ones that are not so skilled and not so successful and kind of trying to work out what's going wrong or even starting out and trying to work it out, you know. But I mean, talking about, you know, when it's kind of like second nature to you, you know, sometimes with a hunter, if you've got the eye for it, sometimes you'll see a deer or an animal in a certain spot.
Mm.
You'll notice yourself every time you drive past, you always look to that same
spot without even thinking.
To see, is that animal back there?
Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah.
Like we saw that fox yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Every time we drive in that area.
I know, I realize, yeah. He, there or not. You were literally checking him out.
It's always there. It's always in your mind because you think he's going to be there. But that's your brain collecting the data and then, you know, and also with the stalking and stuff. When you make a mistake, if you care, when you do care, you'll go, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
Was it the wind?
Yeah.
Did it see me?
I can tell you what went wrong with that fox.
yeah, we know what went wrong. We got it on film.
We were sighting the rifle, and you know, it was shooting on point. It was great, and we were packing up, and you had your 223 with you as well. And Michael goes, hey, there's a fox over here. Quick, grab the 223. And so I grabbed it, and it had gone up over the lip. And like, we couldn't see it.
We're whistling.
Oh, I reckon it's gone. Is it there? Wouldn't it be cool at the start of the video to like have a fox on the ground? That'd be unreal after we've just sighted the rifle. Yeah. and then sure enough, it popped out and I was all set up. I had
lock the bolt down.
Yeah. Finally got the bolt down. And I said to Michael, who was busy focusing on whistling,
yeah,
I said safety up is forward or back, and you kind of, I can't remember even what you said.
I didn't answer because I don't touch
the safety. Yeah, you didn't answer. I should have said is I've moved the safety back or forward or whatever I did to it. Is that right? And you would have said no, and you would have adjusted it, but yeah. I didn't, and didn't
it's
say anything.
Your rifle, so it's obviously
but I mean, yes, I still, it was sort of my fault. It was still funny though, but like, and then I literally had the perfect opportunity broadside. You probably even heard me pull the trigger, and just nothing happened
because it stopped perfect. It was picturesque.
Yeah, and then it was like, oh damn.
When I looked at the rifle, when you didn't take the shot, and I knew you actually tried. The bolt wasn't all the way down.
Yeah,
you had engaged the safety, and so you couldn't get the bolt all the way down.
Yeah.
So until it worked out...
It wouldn't let me drop it because the safety. Yeah,
that's right. So it wouldn't fire. But there's a healthy fox running around up there.
We'll get him tonight.
Yeah.
The second point that I wanted to talk about that you alluded to, and I hear a lot of people talk about this, but I don't think it can ever be overstated. And it goes back to what I was speaking about before about different entry points. But I can't recommend enough that people shoot low caliber, small caliber rifles first a lot. Mm. Like, I think an air rifle is your best friend to start off with, which sounds ridiculous. And I know that it's what's frustrating for people is to invest the money in a small rifle that doesn't execute on their dream of getting a big stag or a big buck. But I like, the more you can put rounds through, become really comfortable, develop really good technique, that when you do move up to that 300 Win Mag or whatever it is, that you've got a foundation to work from. Because I see a lot of issues with people in hunting, and issues that I've faced myself, and people leave hunting because they come in, they're like, I'm going to be a deer hunter. I'm going to buy a 30 cal, and they've never shot anything else, and then it scares them, or it smashes their face, or they're just not good at shooting.
Well, like we were talking about yesterday, is with the follow through.
Yeah.
With those big cals, we all do it. You know, your safety is priority, so you're going to flinch. You're going to pull, and it's a bad habit you'll develop over time when you're using big calibers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So unless somebody's saying follow through with the shot, you won't see the shot land because the recoil's too big, which is why I'm using 223 a lot these days.
Yeah.
So I like to actually be able to squeeze the trigger and see when my bullets
see the impact. Yeah.
See the impact through the scope, through not lifting your head and seeing what's happening, because that's a bad habit as well. You need it. Well, I find it's a bad. Other people probably disagree with me, but I've heard with my own skill.
Yeah.
And my best success is when I try to watch the bullet land and hit the mark.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and like I said to you, when we were out there and I was saying, do this and do that, I'm no professional.
Yeah.
I'm no great shooter either. I'm good enough. I get the job done.
Yeah, yeah.
But I say those things from my mistakes.
Yeah.
And the things that I've stuffed up.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So I.
The following three one's interesting because like, I understand the arguments on both sides. The primary one being, if you keep your eye in the scope, you can follow the animal. You can see the impact. Yeah. Your second shot becomes a lot easier because you don't have to readjust.
100%.
So that's definitely an advantage. The disadvantage with that is if the animal moves quickly and it's now outside of your field of view, finding it bumbling around in the scope is really difficult. It's much easier to pull back. And if you've got a decent, you know, vista in front of you, you can be like, oh, it's now 20 meters, 30 meters there. Now move and then go back in.
Yeah.
So
well, you got to find a balance of that.
You got to find a balance. And I think most people's default position is like, what just happened? And they head up looking around.
You lose the picture.
Yeah.
Because your scope, your rifle recoils so violently.
Yeah.
And you're trying to either look up with your, and sometimes it's too far and you can't see clearly.
Yeah.
And you don't even know what the hell happened.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's in bush.
Yeah. I've done that heaps of times. I've like shot and been like, I have no idea what just happened.
Yeah.
Like I felt good. I was on the animal, but like the blast of the 30 cal and the shock and the movement and the adrenaline, and you're like, and then you feel guilty, especially if you're with someone else and they weren't watching, you're like, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I get gutted.
Yeah. It's hard. Like, it's hard to know what to do like in that situation. But the other thing that people do too much is like punch into max magnification, which sounds like a good idea, but it's actually just makes the reticule bump around and jump around. And then when you're trying to do your follow-up shot, you're like staring through like a tiny pinhole.
That's right.
Trying to find something in the bush is just real difficult.
It is.
Avoid it if you can. Avoid the temptation.
Yeah. I mean, probably six. Depends on what you're shooting and the distances.
Mm.
I never really go over 6 to 8 power. But I rarely ever do that.
Yeah.
I'm not a long distance shooter. If I can get 100 meters or 50 meters, I will.
Mm.
I'll definitely get up that close.
Mm.
I prefer not to shoot over 200, 250.
Yeah, no, I don't like it. I do it if more I than I like.
Because I have no choice, I will.
Yeah.
I prefer anywhere between 50 and 100 meters.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's the Goldilocks zone. I reckon like 80 is a really nice kind of just confident, don't need to move the crosshairs, happy it's going to land.
Mm.
How often do you get 80 meters on a deer without, you know, with plenty of time? It's not as often.
I've been to New Zealand and I shot my red deer in New Zealand.
Mm.
I always wanted to shoot a red deer, but I didn't have opportunities here in Australia, so I thought I'll shoot one in New Zealand. I had the opportunity to. I met the cockatoos.
That was a loud.
Yeah.
We've had black cockies come through and they have a shriek, whereas a cockatoo has like this kind of croaky, obnoxious.
Oh yeah.
That sound.
That's right.
Black cockies sound much nicer.
Yeah, I was doing the Seeker show in New Zealand. And I met a bloke named Sheldon. He comes around and he goes, I've been using your products for a long time. I said, oh, that's awesome. And I go, what do you do? He's like, oh, I'm a guide. And I said, what are you guiding? He goes, red deer, tar, everything.
Hmm.
I'm like, man, I'd love to shoot a red deer. I've never shot a red deer because I don't get the opportunity in Australia. He goes, oh, I'll take you out to shoot a red deer. I go, I'll hold you to it. Don't say that, I'll hold you to it. He's like, nah, book it, let's do it. I'm not joking around.
No.
So yeah, he was true to his word. He's a good guy, really nice bloke. And took me out, shot a good red deer. That was a great experience. I really recommend you do that.
What do you think about the reds in New Zealand? Because they're some of the most incredible reds in the world. It come from New Zealand. But there's this fine line between what I would consider like a nice specimen and then something that's on steroids and just looks like it's
unnatural.
Yeah, it's just like gangliest, massive.
Yeah.
Tines going in every direction. It's like a cage.
I think that's the target of a true trophy hunter.
The Americans love it. There's something that's just like obscene and obnoxiously crazy.
Yeah. I don't call myself a trophy hunter. I'll take the opportunities when I get them.
Yeah.
But I don't, like you would have seen what we've been doing. I mainly go for meat.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the target.
Yep.
If we get a trophy animal, then it's even better.
Like, yeah. It's meat and a trophy, but it's...
But it's usually like, you know, it's a trophy animal would be a byproduct to what we do, if you know, if that makes sense. So, but when I went to New Zealand, it was purely to get something that represents the red deer species.
Yeah. In its prime.
I thought 12 to 14 point is going to be your classic red deer.
Mm-hmm.
With nice thick antlers as well.
Yeah.
So it was heavy set.
Yeah. Solid crown on top.
Solid, exactly. And he was proper matured animal.
Yeah.
I didn't really want those crazy looking things. I don't even know if that's called a red deer anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, it's some abomination.
Yeah.
it's so weird.
It's kind of like a hybrid between elk and red deer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then you got this 50 point, 100 point thing. I don't know. They look amazing, but it just wasn't my taste. It was like, no, I don't think they were ever meant to look like that.
So. That's funny because like what's interesting, and maybe we share this opinion, but I like my red deer and my stags and my chital to be like perfectly symmetrical, nice balance, thick beams, but like classic, like
classic look.
Classic look. I love that. That looks great. But the fallow, make him as gangly and weird and as possible.
Yeah, right.
I'm totally down for that.
Yeah,
because palms can just be silly, and I don't mind that.
Well, around here you could get palms that are uneven. You get one side that's palmed, and the other side just a stick.
Yeah,
you can get that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
fair bit actually.
Yeah,
it's pretty popular.
Yeah, wonky donkeys.
Yeah, so no, I mean, like, on the trophy thing, I also learned that the trophy is not just the antler.
Mm.
You know, people look at, I think people get this a bit wrong. You look at a trophy animal that's got these crazy points and all that sort of stuff, and you'll score it and go, oh, it's a fantastic score on it. I found that once you taxidermy the animal and get it up on the wall, also the coat, the color of the animal, the shape of it,
the girth,
The girth, all that. Also, the quality of the taxidermist's work. It doesn't just come down to the size of the antlers. And I found that out only recently. It was like 5 years ago. I actually found that out.
Yeah.
When I got the red deer up, I know that there's shitloads of better red deer than that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I love this thing.
Yeah.
I fell in love with him. It's like, this is really beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful animal.
Yeah.
I take real notice of when I go around that, you know, Wild Deer Expo. Yeah. Walking around, I was looking at all these crazy red deer and I'm thinking, mine's better looking than that. The antlers are 10 times better. But the way that he's done, the shape that they've got on there, the colors.
Yeah.
Some of the red deer in Australia are not as red, whereas the red deer that I've got.
Bright.
Really bright orangey red. So it's got that. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, there's a lot to it. It's not just go for antlers. It's not the only thing. The other huge thing about trophy shooting is if you can tell a story of your experience of how you shot 100%. The animal.
That's the trophy for me.
It is the trophy. That's the true trophy there. Like we've got a few stories that have happened around here. Like they're very rare. Like bucks and stuff around here are very rare. I should say, like, we're doing some hunting. So I've got a story about the buck I shot. That was about 2 years ago. He was croaking. There was a younger one that was croaking, and he had some females around him. And I looked at him, and I thought, he looks young. He looks like a bit of a pretender. But he's doing all the dance and everything. He's croaking and carrying on. And then I thought, it's starting to get a little bit late. Hopefully something else happens. But
yeah,
it was a real good show he was putting on. And then just out of nowhere, literally 10 meters from where I was sitting, I was like waiting for it on the spot.
Yeah.
Because I was sitting in the bush and there was a clearing just in front of me. It was about 200, 300 meters away is where the action was happening.
Yeah.
And literally 10 meters from where I was sitting, a huge croak just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And the hairs stand up on the back of your neck.
Yeah.
The hell, this is the real deal. This guy is the real.
He's the boss.
Yeah, he's the boss. And he comes running out, charging out of the bush, runs down to the younger one, smashes him, just pushes him out of the way.
Yeah.
Then he starts hurting. And the thing is, like, he's running up his females and he's croaking and that. And the other guy just went off and
he was like, well, I'm done.
Yeah, I'm done. Oh, we're gonna get hurt here.
Yeah.
And then but the thing is, I had a really small channel of where I can actually take my shot.
Yeah, yeah.
So this deer, where he was, I could see him, but I couldn't take a shot at him. Plus, he was a bit too far for my liking.
Yeah.
He had to come to this specific spot where I can actually get that channel, that gap.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got to stop right there, because if he's on the run, I'm not going to be able to hit him. It's not, I'm not going to be quick enough. So I'm sitting there waiting, and the last light, pretty much, he runs right in the front of that spot and stops. I'm like, what? Bang. And that's the story. Like, that's a trophy to me.
That's unreal.
That's the thing.
It's good though that you had like the patience to sit there and just wait it out and make the decision of like, no, this is my shooting lane. This is where I'll have my success. And if he doesn't stop here in the shooting lane, then I'm not going to push it. Like, I'm not going to go try and get closer.
If I moved, it was going to be all over.
Yeah.
Because there's a bunch of females around.
Yeah, eyes everywhere.
You know, it doesn't take much.
No.
You would have seen that anyway. Whenever we get close to deer, I crawl. I literally crawl on my stomach.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Just to get closer.
Yeah. let's go back to the whole gear hunting technology conversation, because I think that's interesting. You've got insights in there that I kind of want to mine. So I asked you this yesterday, but it'd be good to tread out the territory again. Given that you have a business, Eagle Eye, that sells hunting gear, and not just your own stuff, like other people's stuff too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. We do a bunch of various brands
yeah.
that are not my brands, but we partner up with them.
Yeah. And then you have Smart Rest, which is your brand of yeah. like shooting like racks and
yes.
accessories. When it comes to the accessories, given that you have like you're selling, you're distributing and stuff, do you have to like put aside time in your year to think up new ideas and dedicate to the research and the R&D and the building?
Yeah.
Or is it just, and then like this part of the year is for selling, yeah. this part of the year is trying to find new products from other businesses, this part of the year is for making my own, like, or do you, yeah. does it just happen naturally?
It's not as structured as that, but it's yeah. Kind of like I said to you, the obsession and yeah. the insanity.
Yeah.
That's when it really comes into play.
Cause yeah.
like you're constantly designing, I'm constantly thinking, I'm constantly, how can I improve?
Mm.
I always want to improve products. Like no product's perfect
yeah.
that I build. So we get feedback and then let's say I've got a bunch of stock. I won't design anything new until that stock most likely.
Okay, clear. That's one of the triggers is once you get low in stock, you're like, look at the rack and rest.
Yeah, do I continue on with this line or do we make improvements or
yep.
you know things like that? So that's one of the factors. New things will come up as in dealers will ring us up and say, hey, Michael, do you do this? I'm like, yeah, we'll do it. And I go away and design it real quick and I send them pictures and say, yeah, look, it's available. And, yeah, okay, send me some.
I've noticed that you do that, actually. You even yeah. sent me, you were like, HyperPod 3, I'm really excited about it. I'm not sure if it's ready to release yet. I'm like, it's up on your website, but it's like, what do you do? It's like out of stock. I'm like, is it? What's
going on? Well, it's coming soon. It's kind of like a teaser because, you know, we have our dealers that want to make orders, and we've sold out of HyperPod 2, so we don't have the stock. But
yeah, cool.
The 3 is coming, and to make it available for yeah. the pre-orders, I have to have some sort of listing.
Yeah,
I can't just sell a dream.
No, you know, no. You got to have a picture. You got to have a page and prices.
Yeah, we're in production, and dealers usually get the first dibs at making the orders so they can get them yeah. in stock.
Yeah.
Put them in their stores, and then our marketing and our work goes in during that time.
Yeah,
and hopefully most of them are sold by the time we get them landed.
Yeah,
And hopefully there's no problems with them, because we try to also just keep warranties and keep problems to an absolute minimum.
Yeah,
everybody does the same, but
yeah, of course you have to.
Obviously, with a small company, because
that can really burn you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. At the same time, I never want anybody disgruntled. Or,
yeah.
not happy with what we've done. And honestly, coming from a trade background, I was trained really, really hard in yeah. that area where people are paying you money and you've got to deliver something.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're not delivering, you know, they've got the right to say, I'm not paying you.
Yeah.
And that's like my training background. So I've tried to carry that on. I really care. I probably care too much, but that's just how.
No, I think you care enough. In fact, more than enough. Not more than enough. I think more people need to care like you care, to be honest.
Yeah.
And put the level of care into your products and into people wanting to receive the value from the product. Like, that's really clear to me.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone who's not doesn't know what we're talking about in terms of the HyperPod. The HyperPod is a monopod accessory that attaches to your rifle, to the base yeah. of your rifle, and it's like a shooting stick, but it's one singular piece, it's mono. And one of the major advantages, I think, with it is that you don't need to carry around a tripod or a gun clamp.
It makes you much more mobile.
And it is you do have to get used to using it, because it's not something that most people are trained in being used in or used to using. But once you get in the groove with it, it just becomes like a core part of your weapon and helps you shoot.
But you were saying the monopod, which is one pole, but what we realized, because I did try other stuff before I usually try other products that are out there before I go away and try to improve what's already out there. Because, you know, they said, don't fix what's not broken.
Yeah.
Or don't try and reinvent the wheel. So I'm careful not to go into a crazy realm where you're designing crazy things that could possibly work maybe for 10 people.
Yeah.
So I try not to do that. I try to work with what's there. If what's there is working really well and it's like mastered and it's down pat, I don't touch it. I just go, great, excellent.
Yeah.
People should just run with that.
Yeah.
But if I find that, for example, the monopod has no bipod on the bottom. As soon as you hit that thing on the ground and you stick your rifle on it, you're swaying.
Yeah.
You're doing, you're rocking and you're swaying.
Yeah.
Even worse, they use a V. Not to knock anybody's product, because I'm sure people will take these things out and they get great results with them. But I find for myself, just so I don't offend anybody, because there are people that are sending this product, and you know, I'm happy for them.
I love offending people. Yeah. People need to toughen up.
It's not a judgment on other people. It's more what I find, and I find that I can improve something.
Yeah.
So I will add a bipod to the bottom.
Yeah. So that was a ladder addition to
the... No, it was part of the original design.
The original hyperpod?
The hyperpod had a... I was considering a baby tripod.
Yeah, okay.
But it was awkward.
Yeah.
So, no, bipod's enough.
But I like that it's modular. Like, so that's something else that I think that you do well that I was surprised in. Not surprised. Like, it was a pleasant experience to buy a product that has a few different modules, like parts of it, but those parts can be used separately and independently.
Yep.
Or can be attached to other accessories that I can buy from you. Like that's a cool feature. It's not this is the thing, it works in this context and that's it. Mm. It's like, no, you can plug and play and put it on this and put it on that.
Yeah. Well, there's a few companies we work with, like PowerBeam. I've learned a fair bit from their structure, their business structure. And they've got, you know, sometimes you buy a product and inside the product it says, what else do we do? We've got this and this and this you can add. How else can you improve what you do?
Mm.
And all of us love that stuff. Yeah. Like, we're hunters, we're shooters. So when we see like, oh, I can get something that's a bit better and this is a specific design that they do that for, we're like, wow, yeah, let's do that. I'll go for that. So you might not be able to afford it to buy right now, but you go, on my next hunt before I go.
Here's a question for you. And I think it's a complicated answer and you may not have all of it. I'm not sure any of us do, but how do you convince people that they need your product? Like, because the challenging thing about hunting and shooting is that you go out and you learn how to hunt and shoot in a certain way, because that's who's teaching you, and that's based on the gear that they have.
Yeah.
But you're for instance, like I said this to you yesterday openly, like I had to force myself, it's not the right word. I had to be intentional about using the hyperpod because it wasn't part of my normal setup. It wasn't part of my normal shooting strategy or style or technique.
Yeah.
And I knew just by looking at it that I'm like, this is going to help me, because I know there's situations where normally I'm hunting, I'm going to have to look for a tree. I'm going to have to look for a stump. I'm going to have to look for some way to brace myself, or I just shoot offhand and just risk the, you know,
the wobble.
And so for me, I said, okay, I'm convinced. I convinced myself that it was worth doing.
Yeah.
And obviously I had a relationship with you, so that made it much easier to kind of get into that. But brand new hunter, Sandy, she comes along and she, like, how do you convince her that she needs it?
I try not to convince people of anything. What I try to do is just ask them, what do you do?
How do you ask them?
So let's just say it's at a scenario of an expo.
Mm.
People will come up and they'll say, oh, that's interesting. We've got it standing, sitting there.
Mm.
So they'll say, oh, that's interesting. And I'll say, oh, what sort of shooting do you do? I shoot out of a car. That's all I do. I never walk.
Yeah.
So what's the point of me showing them the hyperpod?
Yeah.
So I'll go over, let's go and have a look at the car stuff. It's car related.
Mm.
So, but some people will say, I hate shooting from a car. It's so limiting and it's just scares all the animals away. I want to walk around.
Mm.
I say, okay, well, let me show you some stuff that we have for walking.
Yeah.
And, but if you're talking on just purely marketing and this is outside of expos, you're probably going down the lines of planting seeds.
Yeah.
People see. It used to be easier when social media wasn't blocking hunting, you know, hunters. Like, we'd put posts up on our videos and Mick was one of our marketing guys and we'd send him product and he'd go away and he'd do all these crash hot videos.
Mm.
And then we'd put it up on Facebook and we'd put it up on YouTube. Mm. And
Which were very tasteful videos too.
They were great because they were so hunting.
Headshot, blood explosion.
No.
Like super tasteful, super technical.
Technical, we'd do up scripts and we'd do all the attributes of the product.
Yeah.
And we knew the weak points. So, for example, you go up on top of a hill, you're panting, you're hot, you're whatever, you're struggling, and there's an animal there. It could be shrubby, grass could be this high. We've got perfect conditions most sometimes here, but the grass could be really high and you can't lay down and shoot off.
Mm.
Or the hill could be on a slope.
Yeah.
The animal could be off to the right on a different angle.
Yeah.
You're trying to lay down across the slope.
Yeah.
The animal's on a rise.
Yeah.
You can't get the height. You've got to stand or you've got to lean against a tree. There's no trees around.
Yeah.
So you go, oh, what do? I can't take this shot. Or you take a Hail Mary.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've been in those scenarios personally. So then I know that, okay, if I'm struggling that way, I wonder how many other people are struggling that way. Yeah. Let's make this product and let's put it out there.
Let's assume that other people are.
Yeah.
Which is a good assumption.
Yeah. And then I'll do the research. What have they done? What's out on the market to counter this problem? Mm. Sometimes there's great products out there that are already there.
Mm.
And I go, oh, well, I'm not touching that. It's good enough. And I don't have to do anything. And I'll just go and buy it and use it. From the stuff that I've found, what we've built, the monopod wasn't good enough.
Mm.
The tripod was too heavy to carry around in some of the hills that I walk around in that. Mm. So I couldn't get away with a tripod. So then I thought, I need a pole, but I also need a bipod on the bottom of the pole.
Mm.
I want to be able to carry it, because even the Maxbox, it's great and everything, but it's too low for that sort of scenario.
Yeah.
So I got to know my terrain.
Yeah.
When you know your terrain, you know what you need.
Well, that's the beauty. This is actually something that I've really liked about the Hyperpod, is that with the bipod base, because they're independent pieces, is that there is not a situation that you can get into that you can't accommodate a strong shooting position from with that tool.
Yeah.
It's like, if I'm standing, it's either freestanding, which sucks, or I can put the pole straight down and I can have with the bipod on the base, and I can have a strong position from there. It's like, okay, what's better than that? Well, then kneeling is probably better than that. Lower the center of gravity.
That's right.
Better. And then it's like seated. Can I shoot? And then it's like, you kind of go down the hierarchy, and it's like, the most stable, obviously, being prone on the ground.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, but what do I put my rifle on? It's like, well, and the hyperboard's too big. Then you just pull off the bipod at the bottom. Like, and it's like, whack it. And it's like, there's not a situation that you'll find yourself in that you can't find a stable. And
that was the idea of
pretty
the whole
cool thing. Like, there's not many products that give you that versatility. And I don't want this podcast to sound like I'm just
a hyperpod.
It's just a hyperpod.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was introduced to it, I think even by Dodge originally, Dodge was like, I'm a big fan of this. And I was just like, okay.
He was part of that. Dodge was part of that whole kind of research, trial and error. And,
well, that's what got me into it. I thought, here's a guy that I respect who's using it consistently and he needs to achieve results with it, with the work that he's doing.
Yeah.
So it must be good. Like, that was just the conclusion. So it was like, okay, well then I need to learn how to use it.
Yeah. The last thing on this, last thing on this point, because we banged on about Hyperpod all the whole thing.
Well, we talked about the Hyperpod.
Yeah. I always say, well, anyone that talks to me, I would say, refine your shooting to a point that you don't need the aid to shoot off.
Yeah.
You need to be a good enough skilled shooter that all you're doing with the Hyperpod is assisting your already established skill.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
If you've done that and then you've added the Hyperpod, it makes you an even better shooter, then it's a success.
Yeah.
But if you're only just starting out and you're getting the Hyperpod and you know, you can't shoot for crap and you know, you're constantly fumbling around and you don't know what you're doing, I think it's going to work against you.
Mm.
You need to have your skill down pat first. Yeah. Yeah.
With that said, though, I will give one caveat to that, and partly because I like to play devil's advocate, but partly because I think this is also true. I think that new hunters need to understand that hitting a deer at 100 meters freestanding is a difficult thing to do. Like, it's
underrated because people don't want to admit that they're struggling.
I think it's
admit it straight up. It's not easy.
It's not easy. Like, it's especially if you. So it's maybe it's easier to hit the animal, but it's not easy to cleanly hit it.
Yeah, there's a difference.
Like,
there's a difference.
Like, I just think we need to be open about that, because I think that the fear is that people, we talked about this before with social media influencers and stuff in the hunting space, is that you see stag and buck after stag and buck, and then people start feeling insecure and they go out there and they hold a rifle or like a large rifle, like a 30 cal, and they look through the reticle and they're looking at a 100 meter target and it's like moving, wobbling, and they're like, What's going on? Do I just suck? And part of it is, yes, of course, you can get better at reducing that wobble. You can start working on your, you know, your breathing and just get stronger in your arms and limbs and lots of stuff. But at the same time, there still comes to a point where that's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Well, it's probably accurate that you say, do I do suck? Because, yeah, you suck.
Yeah.
But it's better to say I suck and how can I improve myself?
Yeah.
And if you say, oh, I suck, I'm just no good at this, and give up, then you've lost. You're not giving yourself a chance.
My fear and concern is that people aren't even saying that they suck out loud. What they're doing is they're with other people, they feel like they suck, And they don't say that. And then they give up without voicing it.
Yeah.
Because of the influence, because they just assume that they're doing something wrong or that they're not meeting a standard that's actually not realistic and achievable.
Well, it goes back to the point where you asked me, why do I build certain things? And I'm saying, because I've experienced failure.
Yeah.
You know, and that failure burns me. It burns me badly. And I'm thinking, I need to be better than that. Yeah. I want to find ways to be better. So, you know, if you have that attitude, then, you know, failure just leads to success.
Yeah. Man, I'm the poster boy. I'm the failure poster boy.
We all are. That's it's just you're willing to get it on camera.
Yeah, exactly. I just want it to be permanent. Yeah. I want that failure to go deep. Yeah. I want as many people to know about that failure. But on the flip side is that I'm happy. I don't necessarily want to be, but I'm happy to be the poster boy for growth too. And I don't think you can pick and choose. I think you have to be both. You have to be happy with your failure if you want to be seen to grow and influence and encourage growth.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you're just lying. Absolutely. You're just showing buck after buck after buck. And if my Instagram feed is ever buck after buck after buck, you can slap me.
Yeah.
This is not real. It's not true.
Well, I'll tell you, I've hunted these areas here, you know, I don't know, 8 years. 10 years. I've only ever seen $5. You know, I don't know how common they are in other places, but man, they seem to be everywhere. And I'm like, I never see bucks. Why is everybody shooting bucks? I don't get it. What am I doing wrong?
Well, maybe that's a good place to wrap it up. But what I will say, even though this isn't a Hyperport or Eagle Eye or Smart Risk like podcast promo, if you want a discount on that, you can be a member of the Australian Hunters Club.
Of course you should be a member of the Australian Hunters Club. You should be
a member. Michael's actually a member.
Of course I am.
Finally.
You've got to be.
So you check out australianhunters.com.au if you want to go check out and get a discount, which is well worth it. It's actually worth, if you're interested in buying a Hyperpod or a Rack and Rest or a Maxbox.
Maxbox.
I nearly said all those incorrect.
Quad Rest. Yeah, we do a bunch of rest. It's not only gun rest as well. It's attachments for thermals, because that's just developed as we went along. Thermals came out in the market.
Yeah.
There was no real attachments or mounts for them.
We haven't even talked about the Venom.
Yeah, we can talk about Venom.
This podcast is being filmed right in the middle of episode 2. And tonight we're going to go out with some cool Eagle Eye gear and Smart Rest gear that's worth checking out, some thermal stuff. So if you want to learn more about that, check out episode 2 of The Huntsman season 2. And if people want to learn more about Eagle Eye hunting gear and Smart Rest, where should they go?
Go to the website, eagleeyehg.com.au.
Yeah.
Eagle Eye is spelled with one word. One E, I'm sorry.
That gets me.
Because we can't spell for shit, but that's not the reason. It's eagleyehg.com.au. We kind of joined the two words and thought, I think we better drop the E because it looks terrible with two double E's in the middle.
It does look really weird.
You know? We wanted it one word. So
then it also feels equally awkward when you see it and you're like, not anymore for me because I'm always typing that in. But you're like, Eagle... Oh yeah, he's a why you anyway. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, it's weird, but it's a name. It's not Eagle Eye. It's a name.
It's an Eagle Eye, one thing.
Yeah, one word, one E.
Thanks for joining me, mate.
No worries.
So that was my conversation with Michael Abdenour. I hope that you enjoyed it. I hope that you got something out of it. He's such a fascinating guy. He's such a kind heart. It was an absolute pleasure to talk with him. And if you want to check out that video that comes from season 2 where we actually filmed this, it's episode 2. I will drop a link in the description of this episode so that you can go check it out if you want to. Also, if you're not a member of the Australian Hunters Club, again, I want to plug that. It is the best hunting community in the country. I'm a part of it. Michael's a member of it. I want to encourage you to be a member of the club as well if you're not already. australianhunters.com.au. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your attention, and hopefully I see you in a podcast soon. Bye.